Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is February 28, Sunday, 2010. Bill Fink is with us for the 9th and most likely final installment of Bolshevism in Russia, after which we will probably be moving on to Goebbels and his Bolshevism in Theory and Practice speech, dealing with the German perception of the Bolshevik threat. Anyway, how are you doing tonight, Mr. Fink?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. Praise Yahweh.
I hope tonight's not too mundane. I really didn't prepare any auxiliary material. I'd like to get through this because I think we've done our job here, and even though we have to cover the whole thing, and the important thing is that, you know, I hope through next week that we start to illustrate the impact that this had on Nazi Germany and on 1930s Germany.
And indeed on the world. I mean, here we are living in a Bolshevik world.
Absolutely. And when people consider that the German people knew all about these events that we've laid out from Russia number one and the other things that we brought in to show the horrors of Bolshevism, that is why it was so easy for them to so unanimously elect Adolf Hitler. He's the only politician that stood up in Germany.
That everybody else was either a Jew or in bed with the Jews.
Well, right. If they weren't, if they weren't in bed with the Jews, they were so scared of the Red Threat that they dare not open their mouths.
Isn't that the situation we have today? That we're living in a de facto one-party state, since everybody in both of the major parties is in agreement with the ideology that's running the country, multiculturalism, multiracialism, Zionism, imperialism, foreign entanglements, and anybody who disagrees is either terrorized into silence or they're basically stigmatized and marginalized and they keep quiet.
Well, right, and I believe that the last president that stood up or even the last major politician that stood up to the Zionists paid for it with his life, and that was Jack Kennedy. And you saw what happened to him and Bobby. Well, so did all those politicians. So they wouldn't dare open their mouths. And they would just rather feed like pigs from the trough.
I have to wonder, though, why even play into the game then? If you know that if you speak out you're going to get killed, why even come to the field for the game? Why not just say, hey, I'm not going to be your front pawn, man. Find someone else or do it yourself.
Because they like those campaign contributions and all that money they get to keep and all the
young campaign workers they get to go with.
Yeah, and all the perks. Yeah, you know, all the perks that come with holding office.
So they want the lifestyle.
Absolutely. It's that fast rich lifestyle that they love. That they would never give that up and the feeling of power. Even though they really don't have power, the feeling and the appearance of power is very alluring.
So they've sold out for a facade.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because none of our senators really have power. None of our congressmen or our presidents really have the power to do what they want to do.
That's why whenever someone talks to me about some craziness about going after congressmen, first of all, I remind them it's illegal. Second of all, I remind them that those people are just replaceable pawns and they mean nothing.
Right. I should rephrase that slightly. I should say that the only politicians that actually do have the power to do what they want to do are the ones who willingly want to go along with this globalist international order. And that's like the Chuck Schumers and the other Jews and a lot of the sellouts.
Most of them, they're multiple millionaires. They have hundreds of millions of dollars and they're fat cat Jew bankers on their own. So they don't really need the office to have that kind of money and power and wealth. They already bring it to the table.
Well, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Once you have a position like that, you don't want to give it up. You don't want to give that up. Look at how long Teddy Kennedy stayed in office. No, he didn't have to work. He didn't have to work his whole life. But look at how long he stayed in office.
And along these lines about how they don't give up their power, Nico and I discussed earlier that the Jews are still very much in power in Russia today, despite the fact that ostensibly the Soviet Union has dissolved and disbanded, and it's no longer officially in existence, but it's de facto in existence through the Commonwealth of Independent States and the fact that the Jews in Moscow still dictate what goes on in the Ukraine, what goes on in Belarus, what goes on in parts in some of the Baltic states. They definitely dictate what goes on in Central Asia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. Nothing happens in Kazakhstan that Moscow doesn't approve.
Well, right, and it's going to stay that way for a long time.
So the Jews are not giving up their power anywhere.
No, absolutely not. I mean, they traded, you know, one disease for another. Communism for capitalism, socialism for capitalism. It's no matter it's the Jew. Look at the oligarchs, the 10 oligarchs that ended up owning all of Russian industry after the Gorbachev, after the meltdown and the Yeltsin takeover and all that.
It took over 80 years, but the Russian people wised up to the communist scam, so then the Jews just replaced it with a new capitalist scam.
Well, absolutely. And they've always run both scams anyway. I mean, the whole Cold War was a fraud. It was all controlled and manipulated by the same Jewish bankers.
I've pointed out that the countries that genuinely stood against communism, the countries that genuinely loved freedom and republican democratic values, such as South Africa and Rhodesia, and to a lesser extent, South Korea, South Vietnam, Taiwan, etc., they were all basically thrown to the wolves.
By us!
Exactly. When the U.S. talks about how we lost China, we didn't lose China. We betrayed the Chinese nationalists and handed China over to the red communists.
Absolutely. There's no doubt. And that's even, you know, that's even been posited by some mainstream historians.
And they say that we had to save Africa by handing it over to the communists, and we helped. We didn't just stand by and watch. We actively helped terrorists in one country after another, starting in North Africa, heading all the way down to the South. We basically helped one after another, all those countries, wind up from being productive colonies under white rule with stable governments or under local rule by whites and blacks, heading towards varying forms of government that were more acceptable to the locals. We helped them go from productive, functioning countries to tin pot dictatorships or just outright chaotic anarchist mess.
Well, right, and that's probably what the Jews wanted.
Well, I mean, it's not for nothing that the U.S., the Chinese communists, the Soviets, and the Israelis were financing the same sides in Angola. That's not a coincidence, is it?
Absolutely not.
One might think that odd, though, that the U.S. is ostensibly in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, yet we were training, arming, and funding the same groups in Angola that the Soviets, the Israelis, the East Germans, and the Chinese communists were funding.
Well, it's yeah, you know, Nelson Mandela was at ANC. He was a communist. South African black leaders came from, schools and organizations of communism.
Well, you know, when they talk about the so-called treason trial in South Africa and how there were, I think, 6 or 7 white co-defendants, none of those people were actually white. They were all Jewish communists. One of the more well-known was Joe Slovo, and he was basically Mandela's handler. And if you go to the ANC website today, the African National Congress, the ruling party in South Africa, prominently featured on the front of their website, at least the last time I checked, is a link to the South African Communist Party. I mean, the ANC is basically a toned-down front for the South African Communist Party.
And the only place we don't hear about it is the mainstream American media.
Mm-hmm. So it's very convenient and cute, isn't it, that here we are opposing communism in South Vietnam where it really doesn't matter because the locals didn't really do anything to defend themselves. We had to fight the whole war for them, but we wouldn't give weapons to Rhodesians, Portuguese in Angola, and the South Africans when they were actively fighting and dying to defend their freedom, and they would have used anything we gave them. The Rhodesians were making homemade armored cars because they couldn't get anything imported. They had no tanks at all, yet they fought on for over 15 years.
That shows you the strength, the power of the Jewish media to sway public opinion, to conceal facts from the public when it's their desire to do so.
And
And to cram facts down the public's throat when it's convenient for them to do so. When they want you to know something, they'll play it on the news 24/7 for months.
And then everybody
hears it 100 times, and it's programmed right into you.
And then a year later, it's the one-year anniversary of the so-and-so shooting by white supremacist so-and-so.
And if they don't want you to know something, you're not going to know it. And it's basically, it proves the collusion. It's way beyond, it's so evident, it's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, we hear about that Eric Rudolph almost every year, don't we, on the one-year anniversary of Eric Rudolph. But how many times, most people didn't even hear about the Wichita Massacre the day after it happened.
No, not at all.
And before we begin jumping into the appendix of Russia number one, I would like to read again that one paragraph from number six by the Dutch ambassador stating about how Bolshevism would spread over the entire world. Is that all right? Shall I begin? The foregoing report will indicate the extremely critical nature of the present situation. The danger is now so great that I feel it my duty to call the attention of the British and all other governments to the fact that if an end is not put to Bolshevism in Russia at once, the civilization of the whole world will be threatened. This is not an exaggeration, but a sober matter of fact, and the most unusual action of German and Austrian consul generals, before referred to, in joining in protest of neutral legations, appears to indicate that the danger is also being realized in German and Austrian quarters. I consider that the immediate suppression of Bolshevism is the greatest issue now before the world, not even excluding the war, which is still raging, and unless, as above stated, Bolshevism is nipped in the bud immediately, it is bound to spread in one form or another over Europe and the whole world, as it is organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. The only manner in which this danger could be averted would be collective action on the part of all powers. I am also of the opinion that no support whatever should be given to any other socialistic party in Russia, least of all to social revolutionaries, whose policy it is at the moment to overthrow the Bolsheviks, but whose aims in reality are the same, vis-a-vis to establish proletariat rule through the world. Social revolutionaries will never fight any foreign power, and any profession which they may now make in this sense are merely a tactical move in their struggle with the Bolsheviks. I would beg that this report may be telegraphed as soon as possible in cipher, in full, to the British Foreign Office in view of its importance." End quote. And in light of what he said there, I'm reminded of something I read that Douglas Reed wrote in his book, The Battle for Rhodesia. He wrote in his book, I think it was in 66 or 67 he wrote it, that the American people had lost their sense of purpose since none now existed or could be discerned, and that we had gone off to fight two wars under the pretense of making the world safe for democracy and freedom, and at the conclusion of the first war we fought, communism came about, and then at the conclusion of the second war, communism consolidated its hold over half the world.
And we gave it to them.
He said, you know, so much for fighting for freedom.
The Russians didn't win anything in World War II. We gave it to them.
We basically defeated Germany because they couldn't do it on their own. We defeated Germany and handed them half the world.
Right, and we gave them all of the mechanized forces they need to get as far as they did. I mean, they were our trucks for the most part.
With Lend-Lease, and we never received it back, and they never paid for it, so they might as well just called it giveaway.
Well, the Jews write that off as a business expense because it's really their money, and it's really them who gave them those things.
But it was really the sweat of the American worker on the assembly line who built the truck, wasn't it?
Well, absolutely, but he got his two cents. You know, he got his quarter pound of bread a day, whatever. It's basically the communism and that Dutch ambassador that foresaw the world takeover of Bolshevism. He was a brilliant man for foreseeing that. Don't get me wrong, but what he didn't know was that the Rothschilds and the other Jewish banking families, they wanted it that way. They wanted Bolshevism to prevail.
He couldn't tell that he was making an appeal to the wrong government. The British government was never going to listen to him.
Well, absolutely. And Marxism and communism and socialism and capitalism is the long hard way for the Jews to get our property from us. And all of these, you know, Bolshevism, as we've seen, it is the easy, fast way. And all of these things, they are only the expression, the political expression of Talmudism. And Talmudism teaches the Jew that the goy is cattle, and all of his property really belongs to the Jew. And when you see Bolshevism, Marxism, communism, all that really is the socialization of property so that the Jew can have it all. And that's what we saw in Russia. That's what we saw in the Soviet Union. That's what we've seen in basically all of the socialist states.
I'm reminded of something that I said during the show on Germany and the Jewish problem. First, you pointed out that there were thriving anti-Jewish movements in all of Eastern Europe, and that's why the Soviets were brought in as enforcers after World War II to punish them.
Well, that's what I believe, yes. There were thriving anti-Semitic movements in all of the Eastern Europe before World War II, and they all wanted to that they were all very close to pogroms against the Jews when World War II broke out, and Eastern Europe was rewarded to the Soviets as a scourge to those people.
Absolutely, and then I reminded here I said, quote, "Communism is Judaism without the pretense of the Talmud. The inevitable result of Talmudic morality expressed politically is communism." Communism and Judaism go hand in hand, and the rabbis have even admitted this. Since Talmudism teaches that the goy have no property rights, communism teaches that the bourgeoisie have no property rights, and it just so happens that they classify all the goyim as bourgeois.
Absolutely.
It's a cute coincidence.
And we saw that in the Russia Number One report, that the bourgeois term came to be very widely interpreted.
If you're a father who owns a farm and one of your sons happens to work on your farm, well, now you're a manager because you have one employee, so you're bourgeois.
Absolutely.
Or if you're a barber and you have one person who's apprenticing under you, who you're teaching how to cut hair, now you're bourgeois. Anyone can become bourgeois by having one person working for them.
Yes, and that was used to basically destroy the entire middle class, the white middle class, because that's the real aim of the Jew, is to destroy the entire white working class.
And they've done that very effectively in this country, but it's taken them about 100 years longer than it took them in Russia. Wouldn't you agree?
Right, we're on the slow march in this country, and they just open the spigots everywhere else, That's basically because they made war on Russia the way they did because they couldn't take the slow route.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Tsar wouldn't have a central bank. He wouldn't let the Jew control the economy.
So since he wouldn't allow them to come in, they had to force their way in.
Right, and Satan would rather work by craft.
Mm-hmm. But if you're going to go down, you might as well go down fighting.
Well, right. Exactly, and that's what Adolf Hitler and Christian Germany did, and that's what the Tsar did.
I was going to say, I believe it was Lenin who said that you crush the bourgeois with the between the hammer and anvil of inflation and taxation, and that's what they've done in this country, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, we've been crushed between inflation and taxation, and I've calculated from reports on MSNBC and CNN that we have averaged 17% inflation every year starting since the late 50s, that inflation really began to ratchet up then. Well, they said that money is only worth about, what was it, that in order to be a millionaire today, in terms of 1950s, you would actually need $7 million. So that means 700% devaluation, or 700% inflation.
The easy measure is a loaf of bread. I mean, it was a nickel when the Federal Reserve was founded.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's $3. Not only that's 60 times the price. And not only that, but the loaf of bread that you buy today is garbage compared to what it was 100 mm-hmm. years ago.
Or if you look at it, the government reports that we have, 2 to 3% inflation every year. I would say it's probably closer to 20% inflation every year. And I challenge you to find me a worker who receives a 20% annual raise, unless it's a Jewish banker, in which case they probably get a triple raise every year.
I haven't actually studied the actual inflation rates, but it is higher than the government.
And I'd like to actually read the quote from Douglas Reed right now about America, if that's all right.
Sure.
Page 115, The Battle for Rhodesia. In three lengthy sojourns in America, I felt the subsurface apprehension or fear of the future more and more tangibly. I think its cause is becoming clear. It lies in my diagnosis in incomprehension of today's America. Americans have lost earlier beliefs because these have been taken from them. They have no clear sense of purpose because now none is to be discerned. American state policy, as declared, is to maintain America as a citadel of the free world against the further inroad of the destructive revolution bent on obliterating race, nationhood, familyhood, and religion. American state actions since 1917 have progressively promoted the spread of that revolution. No adult American can remain blind to this contradiction between word and deed. Two stricken presidents, each reelected on the promise of peace, brought America at once into world wars, which in the sequel, after victory, increased the area and power of the revolution. The 20 years following the Second War have seen the continuance of this. America makes local forays against communism, which leave no dent in the thing itself and end in semi-fiasco. Witness Korea, Vietnam, Cuba. Between whiles, American state patronage of the revolution in reality goes on and is plainest to see in Africa, where implacable American pressure for black majority rule has helped bring about the present chaos of racial and tribal warfare in northern Africa, under cover of which communism, leaping over the Middle East and the Indian Ocean, has planted its first overseas colony in embryo at Dar es Salaam, that's in Tanzania, by the way, on the East African coast, whence news about the rest of Africa reaches the ears of, quote, the free world through the BBC and the Voice of America. And it's not for nothing that Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, was basically the epicenter of communism in southern and central Africa. And today, there are tens of thousands of Chinese there basically setting up colonies to rape all the resources out of southern Africa. And the Chinese first made inroads into Tanzania 40 years ago, and they've never left. So
no, they haven't. They have a heart. They have a larger presence in Africa than that.
And all that ever happened in Africa was a transfer of power from the white man who actually cared about maintaining a stable, decent, peaceful society that would be mutually beneficial for the Negro and the white man. And that power was transferred now to communist overlords that could care less what happens. All they want to do is line their own pockets and remain in power indefinitely. And I will guarantee you, the Chinaman that is going to rule over Africa probably 10 or 20 years from now, he cares nothing what happens to the Negro. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely not. They only want the natural resources. That's all they want, period. That Africa is one of the it's one of the richest continents in the world for natural resources, gold, silver, iron, well, not iron, but
chromium.
Well, the diamonds and a lot of the more precious metals.
Oil.
Basically, the Chinese are there to loot and pillage Africa's resources. And they filled the void that the English left when their empire fell apart 50 years ago.
The thing is, though, that the English didn't just come to Africa to loot and pillage. The Boers didn't come there to loot and pillage. They all came to make a home, to build the place up, and to have something great that would withstand the test of time and that would be there indefinitely. They came to better Africa. And where the white man has gone, conditions have improved. The Chinese are just coming there for a few decades to rape and pillage and plunder, loot the country, strip everything bare, and then they're going to go back to China and leave Africa a barren wasteland.
Well, the Chinaman, I'm sure, is aware of something that the white man should be aware of, but is too stupid and drunk on Jewish propaganda to realize, and that's that the Negro or the black African will never ever take advantage of all of those natural resources. Negro will he might let other races in to remove the natural resources from the ground and process them, and then he will fight over the payment, the payoff from that, and use it to abuse his kinsmen. But they're never going to take advantage of those resources on their own. The black man never put a pipe in the ground and drilled oil, and neither did the Arab.
I forget which congressman it was, but I believe it was a United States congressman who pointed out that for thousands of years the Negro crushed diamonds under his feet, walked up and down the entire shore in the coast of Africa. He gazed out at the horizon over out under the ocean, the Atlantic and the Indian, and he never dared dream to fashion a sail, to explore the unknown, let alone to utilize the resources that he was standing on top of.
I don't even think they ever learned to swim. I mean, I could be wrong, but...
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the boundary of one tribal territory ends when they reach a river, since they have no idea how to get to the other side, unless they happen to find a tree that has fallen down, enabling them to walk across.
Well, they were coaxed across the rivers and given rifles to fight the Boers by the English.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, South Africa was, except for a small Bushman population, was when the Boers got there, it was virtually devoid of
it was uninhabited.
Yes, virtually uninhabited, yes.
It's a modern myth that the Boers arrived and exterminated millions of blacks. I had some teacher try and teach that there were millions of blacks in South Africa. The Dutch arrived in the mid-1600s, enslaved millions, killed millions, raped and pillaged, blah, blah, blah. And I pointed out, well, that seems odd since the Xhosa, the Zulu, and all the other Kaffir tribes didn't arrive for another 200 years, and they were only in the northern region around the border of what is today's Zimbabwe. And I said that there were a few thousand Bushmen in the Kalahari, but even they were several hundred miles away from the Cape Colony. And this teacher eventually threatened to dock my grade.
Well, of course, because you're going against the propaganda. You can't go against the propaganda.
And when they said that the Boers were enslaving all these blacks, I said, prove it. And that was pretty much the end of that discussion.
Well, let's read from the Russia number one report, shall we?
All right. Would you like to start the appendix?
Extracts from the Russian press. Extract from the Krasnaya Gazeta, or the organ of the Red Army, September 1st, 1918. Article entitled Blood for Blood begins in the following way. We will turn our hearts into steel, which we will temper in the fire of suffering and the blood of fighters for freedom. We will make our hearts cruel, hard, and immovable, so that no mercy will enter into them, and so that they will not quiver at the sight of a sea of enemy blood. We will let loose the floodgates of that sea. Without mercy, without sparing, we will kill our enemies in scores of hundreds. Let them be thousands. Let them drown themselves in their own blood. For the blood of Lenin and Yuritsky, Zinoviev and Volodarsky, let there be floods of the blood of the bourgeois. More blood, as much as possible. That's the typical bloodthirsty Jew.
And when they talk about the blood of Lenin, Zinoviev, neither of them were dead at this point.
Now this is this was printed in that paper, in that newspaper on that day.
It makes it sound like it's a call to avenge these people, but I believe only Yuritsky of the four is actually dead at this point.
Right, only Yuritsky is actually dead, and a Jew killed him.
Yeah.
The bourgeois didn't kill him, a Jew killed him. And we're going to see that right in the next paragraph. Extracts from official journal Izvestia, September 1918. There are only two possibilities. The dictatorship of the bourgeois or the dictatorship of the quote-unquote proletariat. The proletariat will reply to the attempt on Lenin in a manner that will make the whole bourgeois shudder with horror. On the assassination at Petrograd of Commissar Yuritsky by Canagesser Jew Dvoryanin.
His middle name was Jew.
No, it seems to me that Canagesser is an
adjective,
the town, and he's a Jew, and his name is Dvoryanin. 22 years of age, a student, formerly Junker of Artillery School. Krasnaya Gazeta writes, the whole bourgeois must answer for this act of terror. Now that's just, that's blatantly evil. Thousands of our enemies must pay for Yuritsky's death. We must teach bourgeois a bloody lesson. Death to the bourgeois.
Oh, and I just looked up something. Volodarsky was also dead at this point. He had been assassinated a few weeks before by a Jewish revolutionary. And Volodarsky, in case you didn't know, was born Moshe Markovich Goldstein. And he was assassinated by Grigory Semyonov, a member of the Socialist Revolutionary Party.
I think he was only mentioned briefly in this report. I'm not even positive. Maybe I'll.
So it looks like when one Jew disagrees with another Jew and blows his brains out, somehow the bourgeois is responsible.
Well, right. It's the white man's fault. It's the white man's fault for making the Jews do this to each other, I guess. And,
so
and just not.
We take the blame for everything they do. They blame the Germans for lampshades and soap, but that's things that they've actually done during the Bolshevik Revolution. They put all of their problems and project all of their hideous traits onto other people who are blameless.
Well, they're God's chosen, right? They can't be blamed. That's incredible. Their Jewish hypocrisy is absolutely astounding. And the mind of Satan, and Satan runs this world today, and most Christians have given right into them, not knowing just how diabolical they are.
But I mean, it all began
because
with a lie 6,000 years ago.
Well, right. It all began with a lie, yes, 7,500 years ago. But they don't read. Our biggest failure is that we simply don't read. And when we do read, it's usually Jewish pulp novels produced by Jewish publishing houses.
I basically did a paraphrase of what you said, and I said the Jews have nothing to worry about from people that simply spend their time reading novels, and they said, prove it. I said, prove it? That's an opinion. What do you want me to do, cite scientific studies that validate my opinion?
Well, their attitude right there proved it. Okay.
When they were trying to discuss the greatest American authors ever, and they were all naming novelists, and I came in and I said Stoddard and Grant, hands down. And then they basically lambasted me and called me a racist. And they said, oh, you think that the only great works to come out of America are works of racist BS and crap? And I said, well, they were both nonfiction writers who were trying to raise the alarm and get the American people to save their nation. I think that's more important than a tale about a white whale.
An attempt on Lenin. Proclamation issued by the Extraordinary Commission and signed Peters. Odd. Proclamation states that the criminal hand of a member of the Social Revolutionary Party, directed by the Anglo-French, has dared to and I don't think there's any substantiation for that whatsoever, has dared to fire at the leader of the working class. And there's no substantiation for that either.
He's the leader of the working class who never does any work.
Right. This crime will be answered by a massive terror, quote unquote. Woe to those who stand on the path of the working class. All representatives of capital will be sent to forced labor and their property confiscated. Counter-revolutionaries will be exterminated and crushed beneath the heavy hammer of the revolutionary proletariat. Petrovsky, Commissar for Interior, issues a circular telegraphic order reproving local Soviets for their extraordinarily insignificant number of serious repressions and mass shootings of white guards and bourgeois. So they're not killing enough people. Okay. And
I wonder what would the Jews today say about this? Would they just outright deny this, or would they say that this is a forgery, a document that's on par with the Protocols of Zion?
It's incredible. I got to think of a way to get this into a more prominent position on my Mein Kampf site. An immediate end must be put to these grand motherly methods. All right social revolutionaries must be immediately arrested. Considerable numbers of hostages must be taken from bourgeois and former officers. At the slightest attempt at resistance or the slightest movement in white guard circles, mass shootings of hostages must be immediately employed. Indecisive and irresolute action in this matter on the part of local Soviets will be severely dealt with. So if you just go wantonly and just killing people, then you're being a grandmother. That's
all right. So
attitude.
My question here is, the Jews that claim 6 million of them were thrown in the ovens and killed in World War II, can they produce a contemporary document in the German newspaper saying the Jews must die, kill 6 million Jews? Because here we are producing documents contemporary, at the time, on the ground, as this is occurring. The Soviets are saying we're going to kill millions.
Right. That's basically what they're saying. And nobody condemns the Jews for it.
And you'll never see
but
a movie.
But all Germans are condemned for the Holocaust.
You'll never see a movie come out of Hollywood showing the Red Terror, will you?
Well, they are the Red Terror. They're just the propaganda wing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are the accomplices in this.
They're not going to point the finger at their cousins over in Moscow and Kiev.
Well, they're just the public relations wing of the same outfit. That's all they are. That's all Hollywood is. And that's all the American media is.
All right. Shall I read terrorism?
I guess.
Terrorism. The Council of the People's Commissaries, having considered the report of the chairman of the Extraordinary Commission, found under the existing conditions it was most necessary to secure the safety of the rear by means of terror, to strengthen the activity of the Extraordinary Commission and render it more systematic, as many responsible party comrades as... Wait, is it the next page? Oh, I forgot to read the footnote. I'm sorry. Footnote. The Extraordinary Commission are responsible for the trials and executions and for executions without trial. The work is sometimes done in camera. As many responsible party comrades as possible are to be sent to work on the commission. The Soviet Republic must be made secure against its class enemies by sending them to concentration camps. Oy vey, the camps. We'll never hear about this, though, will we?
Never. No, the Germans invented them. They didn't exist yet at this time.
All persons belonging to White Guard organizations or involved in conspiracies and rebellions are to be shot. Their names and particulars of their cases are to be published. Northern Commune, September 9, 1918. Tiver, 9 September. The Extraordinary Commission has arrested and sent to concentration camps over 130 hostages from among the bourgeois. The prisoners include members of the Cadet Party, Socialist Revolutionaries of the Right, former officers, well-known members of the propertied classes, and policemen. Northern Commune, September 10, 1918. Yaroslav, 9 September. In the whole of the Yaroslav government, a strict registration of the bourgeois and its partisans has been organized. Manifestly anti-Soviet elements are being shot. Suspected persons are interned in concentration camps. Non-working sections of the population are subjected to compulsory labor. Northern Commune, September 10, 1918. Here they are making people register. This seems like what the Jews claim, that the Germans made all Jews register. I wonder if that actually happened, though.
Oh, probably not. I haven't seen that. There's a lot of things I haven't seen documentary evidence of.
I want contemporary documents from some German officer in 1942 that explicitly states, today we killed X amount of Jews, tomorrow hopefully we'll outdo ourselves. Or, you know, today we killed X amount of Jews, I feel so bad about it, I need to get a beer right now and drown my sorrows. How can we do these things? But I have never seen a document along any of those lines, have you?
No.
There's no contemporary document on the ground at the time by somebody who was supposedly involved. It's all after-the-fact speculation with dubious eyewitness accounts, statements that are contradicted, easily debunked, or confessions extracted by the Soviet NKVD. And quite frankly, I'm sure if you gave them 10 hours with me, they could probably get me to confess to starting the Chicago fire, but it wouldn't make it so. At Karsk, 11 September. Yesterday, martial law was proclaimed in the town. 8 counter-revolutionaries were shot. Northern Commune, September 12, 1918. Boris Globesk, 16 September. For an attempt to organize a movement in opposition to Soviet power, 9 local counter-revolutionaries were shot, namely 2 rich landowners, 6 merchants, and the local corn king, Veselayev. Northern Commune, September 16th, number 106. And I'm sure corn king just means that he grew enough food for his family and a bit to trade with his neighbors. Resolution passed by the Soviet of the 1st Urban District of Petrograd. Quote, the meeting welcomes the fact that mass terror is being used against the White Guards and higher bourgeois classes and declares that every attempt on the life of any of our leaders will be answered by the proletariat by shooting down not only hundreds, as is the case now, but of thousands of White Guards, bankers, manufacturers, cadets, constitutional Democrats, and socialist revolutionaries of the right. Northern Commune, September 18, 1918. Now, I highly doubt they were shooting any Jewish bankers. I imagine they were shooting what few bankers were actually genuine whites to make room for more Jews. Since, as we've shown before, a lot of the Jews managed to get out of Russia with all their banking money intact.
Right. We saw evidence of that earlier in these reports, that they let a lot of the Jewish capitalists go.
Mm-hmm. And they probably just came to this country to set up the Frankfurt School, or to help the German Jews set up the Frankfurt School.
I'm certain. I'm certain. Where are they going to? They're not going to flee east. I mean, there's no future for them there.
You're not going to see the Jews fleeing to Kazakhstan or Turkey or Persia.
No, they're only banished to regions like that. They never flee to those regions.
They want to come to the rich West. Parasites want productive hosts. The following telegram has been received from the Calvary Corps staff. Quote, additional arrests have been made in connection with the affair of former officers and civil service officials involved in preparing a rising in Volgoda. When the plot was discovered, they fled to Arkhangel and to Murmansk. The prisoners were caught disguised as peasants. All had forged papers on them. The political department of the Corps has in its possession receipts for sums of money received by the arrested persons from the British through Colonel Kurtenkopf. In connection with this affair, 15 have been shot, mostly military men. Among them were General Ashtahov, military engineer Bordorovsky, Captain Nikitin, and two socialist revolutionaries of the left, Sudetin and Taroba. Apart from these, the commander of the expeditionary detachment and sailor Shimiansky, who was not equal to the situation, was also shot. Northern Commune, September 19, 1918. So they're saying that his involvement wasn't on par with the others, but they shot him anyway. Is that basically it?
That's basically it. He was not equal to the situation.
But they shot him anyway.
Well, right. He must have been a bourgeois. He was a sailor. He must have had a.
he owned a boat.
Yeah.
Or a canoe.
That's incredible.
To overcome our enemies, we must have our own socialist militarism. We must win over to our side 90 million out of the 100 millions of the population of Russia under the Soviets. As for the rest, we have nothing to say to them. They must be annihilated. Speech by Zinoviev, reported in Northern Commune, September 19, number 109. Now, can anyone show me a speech where Hitler stands up and says, I have to win over 9 out of 10 of you, the rest of you can go die?
Never. Never any such speech. But the incredible thing is that I don't see the ratio, the 9 out of 10 ratio. It was more like 6 out of 4 and everybody else died.
Or, you know, maybe 9 out of 10 of the Jews will be spared. 1 out of 10 of the Jews are killed for not going along with the plan. But it seems of the genuine white Christian Russians, they probably killed a third to a half.
Well, at least a third, I would say. Yeah, over through the Stalinist period, especially.
Absolutely. The work of the Extraordinary Commission is most responsible and calls for the greatest restraint of their members. Do they possess this restraint? Unfortunately, I cannot discuss here whether and how far all the arrests and executions carried out in various places by the extraordinary commissions were really necessary. On this point, there are differences of opinion in the party. The absence of the necessary restraint makes one feel appalled at the instruction issued by the All-Russian Extraordinary Commission to All-Provincial Extraordinary Commissions, which says, quote, the All-Russian Extraordinary Commission is perfectly independent in its work, carrying out house searches, arrests, executions, of which it afterwards reports to the Council of the People's Commissaries and to the Central Executive Council. Further, the Provincial and District Extraordinary Commissions, quote, are independent in their activities, and when called upon by the Local Executive Council, present a report of their work, end quote. Insofar as house searches and arrests are concerned, a report made afterwards may result in putting right irregularities committed owing to lack of restraint. The same cannot be said of executions. It can also be seen from the instruction that personal safety is to a certain extent guaranteed only to members of the government, of the Central Executive Council, and of the local executive committees. With the exception of these few persons, all members of the local committees of the Bolshevik Party, of the control committees, and of the executive committee of the party may be shot at any time by the decision of any extraordinary commission of a small district town if they happen to be on its territory, and a report of that made afterwards. From an article by M. Olminsky, Pravda, October 8, 1918, and they call it the All-Russian Extraordinary Commission, but I wonder how many people in the commission were actually Russians.
Probably none. Probably a very small minority of sycophants just because they like to eat.
Or that they had three token Russians and they were all married to Jewesses.
Basically, that's the way most of the Central Committee structure looks.
And then we covered, what was it, in Bloody Red Streak, that there was one genuine white Christian in the communist government in Hungary, and he was executed for anti-Semitism.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was.
And here we are. They admit that irregularities over house searches and arrests are often corrected, but the same can't be said of executions. That pretty much goes without saying, though, doesn't it? That if they blow your brains out and then decide that they were too quick to shoot you, there's really no way to rectify that. But, of course, that won't stop them from going out and doing it five times the next day.
Absolutely. The satanic injustice is incredible. You can't say that. I don't have the adjectives for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's amazing if you think about it. This behavior is entirely fitting for people descended from a being that tried to rise up and make himself greater than God. Should we expect anything less from them?
No, they're totally criminal. They're totally evil. And it comes. It doesn't come out in all of them all the time, but it comes out in enough of them some of the times that you end up with what you have here.
Comrade Bokev gave details of the work of the Petrograd District Commission since the evacuation of the All-Russian Extraordinary Commission to Moscow. The total number of arrested persons was 6,220. 800 were shot. From a report of a meeting of the Conference of the Extraordinary Commission, Izvestia, October 19, 1918, number 228. A riot occurred in the Kursunov district. The rioters shouted, "Down with the Soviets." They dissolved the Soviet and the Committee of the Village Poor. The riot was suppressed by a detachment of the Soviet troops. Six ringleaders were shot. The case is under examination. Izvestia, November 5, 1918.
Now, if this was happening here in the 60s, you know what the liberal press or the Jewish press would be doing?
Oh, well, we'd still have coverage today. They'd write songs about it. Remember the Six, Remember the Six.
Well, right, exactly. It's incredible.
I mean, they wrote songs about the Kent State incident. They've immortalized it.
What's really incredible is that everything the white people don't see, that everything the Jews do, that they do because they're fighting a war against whites.
Mm-hmm.
So the Jews act one way at one time and another way at another time. And in other words, when evil is convenient or to the Jewish side, that they're going to trumpet it as heroic or just not tell you about it at all.
Or when it works for them, they make an appeal to justice or what they purport to represent as justice, but it's really injustice for our people. They parade it out as justice and say that we have to get behind ending the war in Vietnam, but at the same time, we need to give military aid to Israel and get ready to go to war to defend them against the people that are defending themselves from Israeli aggression.
And what I'm trying to say, I think, is that watching the behavior of the Jewish media throughout all of the horrors of the 20th century, the white man who had any sense of racial awareness at all should immediately recognize that the Jewish media behaves in the way it does throughout all these various events because they're conducting a war against the white race.
Absolutely. Their behavior basically remains the same. They do whatever they can to detriment us. If it detriments us to appeal to communism, they appeal to communism. If it detriments us to appeal to capitalism, they appeal to capitalism.
And if it detriments us to appeal to justice, they appeal to justice. And if it if it detriments us that they conceal injustice, they do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, if they want something to have coverage, it will have nonstop 24-hour coverage until they decide to stop the coverage.
Absolutely.
Or if they want, it'll never see the light of day, such as this report.
Okay, I think you have one more paragraph here.
All right. By order of the Military Revolutionary Committee of Petrograd, several officers were shot for spreading untrue rumors that the Soviet authority had lost the confidence of the people. All relatives of the officers of the 86th Infantry Regiment, which deserted to the whites, were shot. Northern Commune, quoted from Russian Life, Helsingoffs, March 11, 1919. And this
they
just
lost.
Proved...
The Soviet...
They never... Oh, sorry, go on.
I'm sorry. The Soviet authority lost the confidence of the people, is what they were reporting.
Well,
the Jewish media does that here every time they take a poll, and they announce the phony skewed results of the poll.
I posted on your website an Obama poll. That they got an Obama poll up on a local news site, and I happened to get a screenshot of it. Since I said to myself, they're going to take this poll down, and it was about 11:50 p.m. I think about 80% of people disapproved of Obama. They gave him either a C, D, or an F, and about 20,000 people had voted. The next morning, I got up and I looked at it, and it said only 800 people had voted. And I looked at it; they had reset the poll. But I had a screenshot of before, and then I had a screenshot of after with the timestamps proving that they reset the poll. And the results wound up being virtually identical. The same ratio of people still disapproved, but it was just overall an absolute lower number.
I remember seeing that. I think I went and voted in the second poll.
But that's what they do. If the poll doesn't go their way, they scrap it. Or like O'Reilly, he'll say that the poll was skewed by posters on hateful sites such as Stormfront, so we had to remove the poll. Well, how is that skewed if you just notify your friends, hey, there's a poll going on, go vote? That's not skewing. Skewing would be if you hack in and you make 1,000 votes one way or the other. Did you know, though, that the Jews actually have a device? It's in the shape of a little software program. It runs in the background like an antivirus system, and it gets regular updates from some central Jewish committee. And then if it finds a poll relevant to Israel, you get an alert pop-up. It'll come up from the right-hand side of your screen in the corner in the toolbar. It'll come up. It'll flash big. It'll maximize a box, and it'll say, alert, 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 there's a poll concerning Israel. Here's how the committee suggests you vote. Please go vote. The little bullhorn, the Give Israel Your Support, I think that's the name of the program. And they actually pay. The state of Israel pays ex-soldiers and Jewish college students overseas several thousand dollars every few months as a stipend to spend at least, you know, X amount of hours per day going to forums and posting pro-Israeli posts, voting in surveys and polls, so they skew things to make people think that the bandwagon supports Israel and you better get on the bandwagon.
Well, I'm sure that most of the trolls in all the right-wing forums are actually bought and paid for by the Israelis.
Oh, yeah. Every time I encounter a Jew in a forum, and they're bashing apartheid South Africa but praising uber apartheid Israel, it eventually comes out that they're an Israeli Zionist, they're actually a dual citizen, or they're just an American Jew who has a hard-on, pardon my language, for Israel.
The patterns of behavior I've seen, you know, I don't go chasing down the people that I disagree with.
No.
And ramming my opinions down their throat. Yeah, you know, if they want to come to me and have a debate, that's fine. But I don't go chasing down guys like Troublemaker. He comes here. Yeah, you know what I mean? And white people, as a rule, do not go chasing down people they disagree with or their adversaries to cause trouble.
No,
we
I
don't
avoid
do
them.
That. It's simply not a part of our inherent behavior. Only Jews do that.
They're ultra paranoid, aren't they? They think that they have to preemptively attack us because we're out to get them. And the problem is that we're not out to get them. If our race knew what was going on, maybe we would be out to get them, and it would be rightfully so. It seems that, if anything, we're far too generous to them.
Absolutely. We are absolutely far too generous to them.
I remember a Goebbels speech, though. Goebbels said that one day our patients would wear thin and we would shut their lying mouths for them. And that day is coming, but I think it's going to be Yahweh who shuts their lying mouths. We can't pull it off on our own. We've had how many thousands of years to do it? It seems that history continually repeats itself, doesn't it? From the fall of Greece to the fall of Rome, down to the fall of the United States of America.
Because history repeats itself because people don't read and learn from history. If we read and learned from history, history would not repeat itself.
What's happening now is not new. This is just a repeat of things that have happened in cycles. We're just in another cycle.
Right. It's a very true adage that those who don't learn history are bound to suffer, you know, the repeat of it. That's the way it is.
The Jews are done with this empire, so they're tanking it.
Treatment of the bourgeois. Orel. That's an abbreviation for something I don't understand. No.
I think that's the actual town. O-R-E-L.
Okay. Today, the Orel Bourgeois commenced compulsory work. Yes, it must be a town. Commenced compulsory work to which it was made liable. Parties of the bourgeois, thus made to work, are cleaning the streets and squares from rubbish and dirt. Well, I don't think so, that they're not removing Jews. Kembar, the bourgeois put to compulsory work, is repairing the pavements and the roads. The first report was from Izvestia, October 19th. The second from Pravda, October 6th, 1918. Next report. If you come to Petrograd, you will see scores of bourgeois laying the pavement in the courtyard of the Smolny. I wish you could see how well they unload the coal on the Neva and clean the barracks. From a speech by Zinoviev in Pravda, October 11th. Next. Large forces of mobilized bourgeois have been sent to the front to do trench work. Krasnaya Gazette, October 16th. A camp for the bourgeois. The District Extraordinary Commission of Saransk has organized a camp of concentration for the local bourgeois and kulaki, meaning the closed-fisted. The duties of the confined shall consist in keeping the town of Saransk. Oh, what do I have here? It seemed like text was missing, but it's not. The existence of the camp will be maintained at the expense of the same bourgeois. So they have to make the camp and they have to pay for it. And somebody else will live in it. I think that's a biblical prophecy.
I think that's out of Deuteronomy 28, isn't it? That you shall build a house but not dwell therein.
It seems to me. That was from the Krasnaya Gazette, the Red Gazette, Petrograd, November 6th.
So the Jews require them to build the instrument of their enslavement.
Well, right, the concentration camp. And there are no concentration camps until Hitler invented them. So I don't know. I'm in a quandary here. I'm being sarcastic. All
also,
right?
I thought forced labor and slavery were things that could only be perpetrated by white males in this country against blacks or by Germans against Jews in World War II.
Well, right. Concentration camps, I think the first time they appeared was in the Boer War.
Yes, the British coined the term concentration camp.
Yes, and here we have camp of concentration. And are you going to tell me that the Jews in Russia learned from the British? Or is it the same Jews who did the concentration camps in both places?
Absolutely. The British government was run by Jews. The entire Boer War was at the behest of the Jews, wasn't it? Who wanted the gold and diamonds from the Transvaal and the Orange Free State?
Well, of course. It seems to me that the Jews invented the concentration camp, one of their great, great contributions to mankind. Desertions from the Red Army. The flight against desertion. The Goyos, G-O-I-O-S, that's awfully close to the word Goy. Krasnoarmeteza, I'm sorry, I'm butchering that word. It means the voice of the Red Army men of the 2nd of February, issued at Yamburg by the 6th Light Infantry Division, contains the following announcement. In view of the mass desertions of Red Army men, and the necessity of putting a stop to those citizens agitating among them against Soviet authority and spreading among them false rumors, causing panic among the Red Army and in the rear, and also concealing deserters, persons who are in reality agents of Anglo-French capital. There's the lie again. I guess any resistance was seen as agents of the Anglo-French, right?
Is there such a thing as Anglo-French capital?
No. The Anglo-French capital would be the Rothschilds that funded the Bolsheviks. It's incredible, the propaganda. Such persons are subject to arrest and to delivery to trial by the Military Revolutionary Tribunal as enemies of the workers' and peasants' government. So the government belongs to the workers and peasants, eh? That's funny. All town, district, and village Soviets of the frontal zone of the Yamburg district and of the neighboring districts are instructed by the Military Soviet of the division and by the Yamberg District Executive Committee to bring to the immediate notice of the Military Revolutionary Tribunal all cases of wandering Red Army men, to detain all persons spreading false rumors, to arrest private persons, as well as Red Army men detected in selling or buying military arms and munitions, and to place on all roads barrier guards and patrols for the apprehension of the deserters. The Military Revolutionary Tribunal brings to the notice of Red Army men that the time for words and exhortation has passed, and that the time has come demanding the conscious performance of the tasks of the Soviet Republic. The concealment and the misplaced solicitude of workmen and peasants in relation to deserters are abetting the licentiousness and idleness in the ranks of the Red Army. A deserter needs neither bread nor a refuge, but a bullet. Bread and a refuge are due only to the proletariat Red Army, the Military Revolutionary Tribunal at the front.
And it seems that when they say the tasks of the Soviet Republic, they've already made clear what those tasks are when they say as much blood as possible several pages ago. And when they said that they have to kill, what is it, 10% of the society at the bare minimum.
You know, it startles me that the amount of propaganda that's inherent in the language in these bulletins and these announcements already by 1918.
They talk about how they are the government of the workers and peasants. Yet the workers and peasants have no say, and if they question the government or the accepted platform, they get shot as an enemy of the people.
Right, and there's a lot of such subtle there's a lot more subtle propaganda built into the language and into the titles and things like that. It's incredible. They had it perfected only a year into the revolution. It's like they made up all the propaganda before they started.
They certainly at the time, though, they've been planning this revolution for decades.
Yeah, sure, I'm sure. But they actually wrote it all down, and they must have had a Bolshevik manual or something, I don't know.
Well, I'm sure they do, don't they? The Talmud.
Yeah, really.
And the Protocols of Zion.
Do you want to proceed with Bolshevism and social democracy?
Right. Bolshevism and social democracy, arrest of the labor conference, an open letter of the delegates kept in the Moscow Taganaka prison to all citizens. We, members of the labor conference, representing independent working class organizations of various towns of Russia, Petrograd, Moscow, Tula, Sermova, Kolomna, Kolbaika, Tver, Nizhny Novgorod, Vologda, Bezhveza, Orel, Votkinsky, Zavod, arrested at our second meeting on the 23rd July in the Cooperation Hall, feel it our public duty to protest before all citizens of Russia against the false and calumnious reports published by the Bolshevik government present on the 27th and 28th July. The Bolshevik government takes advantage of the fact that it has muzzled the whole independent press and that we, members of the labor conference, are locked up in prison under incredible conditions. Quote, our conference was not a secret counter-revolutionary plot organized by well-to-do people and intellectuals, but a public conference of delegates of working class organizations, which was beforehand known to and discussed by the whole press, including that of the Bolsheviks. The delegates were sent to the conference not by Mensheviks or social revolutionary groups, as falsely stated in the Izvestia, which desires to deceive workmen who have not yet deserted the government, but by assemblies of delegates from works and factories who have tens of thousands of electors behind them. The adopted general basis of representation was one delegate for 5,000 workmen. The Izvestia goes so far as to state shamelessly that the delegates, Paula Karpov and Pushkin, sent by the Tula workmen, were elected by 60 or 160 men, whereas they were sent by the Tula Assembly, which consisted of delegates elected by the majority of Tula workmen. At places where independent workmen's organizations could not yet be set up, delegates to the conference were sent by individual big factories. Having calumniously described the delegates as impostors who represent nobody, the Izvestia, with the insolence characteristic of the organs of the Tsarist regime, did not stop at giving false information about things found on the arrested delegates in order to cast a shadow on their character. Thus, it is reported that Comrade Berg, was found to be in possession of 6,000 rubles. As a matter of fact, he had only 590 rubles. Comrade Lykin is stated to have had 160 rubles, and he had in fact 1 ruble and 65 kopecks. The Izvestia further states that on Lykin was found the following things: a ring, diamonds, and a gold watch, whereas all his jewelry consisted of an ordinary gunmetal watch, which it did not occur even to the prison wanderers to take away. Prison warders. The Bolshevik government has to resort to stupid, shameless lies to justify the preposterous arrest of the workmen's delegates who dared to show some independent organizing initiative. And if I recall, did not Zinoviev say a few reports ago that if there were a referendum against him and if the people demanded it, that the entire Bolshevik government would resign?
Yeah, right. Like that would come to fruition.
Or like if there's a referendum against him, all the people that voted against him will be escorted away as enemies of the people and then shot.
Absolutely.
The Conference of Workmen's Delegates was convened to make arrangements for the convocation of an all-Russian Labor Congress and had held 2 meetings. The agenda of the conference included the following items: measures against the disintegration of the working class movement, what can be done to affect the concentration of its forces and its proper organization, arrangements for the all-Russian Labor Conference. But the communist government, just as its czarist predecessors, do not tolerate any symptoms of an independent working class movement, because it is this movement which constitutes a menace to their power. In this movement, they see a reflection of the food crisis, and incapable of solving the state problems which they have before them, they resort to repressive measures directed against the leaders of the working class movement. Workmen's organizations are subjected to unheard-of repressions. And I'd like to point out here that his accusations against the Tsarist government are unfounded, since these groups were having above-ground meetings openly plotting against the Tsar. So clearly, if the Tsar was as repressive as they say, wouldn't all these people have been arrested and shot in 1915 or 1916?
Exactly. Just like we should have rounded up and shot all the Jewish radicals in the 60s, but look what happened. And in a society, it never happened.
They claim this country has no freedom, yet here they were in the 60s firebombing ROTC barracks as bellyaching that they weren't free to speak their mind. They didn't want to speak their mind. They wanted to burn and bomb. Long live the working class organizations. Long live their independence, their revolutionary and organizing initiative. Signed, A.N. Smirnov, workman of the cartridge factory, delegate from Petrograd. N.N. Glebov, workman of Putlov Works. J.S. Lykin, delegate of the Assembly of Delegates of the Nizhny in Vladimir Districts. Workman, D.Z. Zakharov, secretary of a trade union. D.I. Zakharov, Sermovo. V.I. Matveyev Sermovo, A.A. Veselkom, carpenter, member of the executive committee of the Lettish Social Democratic Party. I.G. Volkov, turner, member of the executive committee of the Petrograd Union of Metalworkers. A.A. Chinnikov, Nizhny. S.P. Pulikarpov, Tula. N.K. Boronezko, Petrograd Tube Works. V.G. Cherkin, turner, member of the All-Russian Council of Trade Unions. Berg, Electrical Works. D. Smirnov, Arsenal Petrograd. Victor Alter, delegate of the Executive Committee of the Bund, Jewish Socialist Party. Pushkin, workman of the Tula Small Arms Factory, etc. Workers International, organ of the Petrograd Committee of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, August 7, 1918. And it seems this is another opportunity where we can point out that the Netherlands ambassador said that these organizations differ in cosmetic appearance, but their actual aims and goals are no different from the Bolsheviks. Would you agree that all these people are basically Bolsheviks under a different name?
Well, right. They're all Bolsheviks under... They all, if any one of these other socialist parties had risen to power, the same result would have occurred.
Mm-hmm.
That there's no doubt.
The imaginary dictatorship of the proletariat has definitely turned into the dictatorship of the Bolshevik Party, which attracted all sorts of adventurers and suspicious characters and is supported only by the naked force of hired bayonets. And we've already shown they had to bring in hundreds of thousands of Chinese and Lithuanian Letts and foreign Jews to prop up their regime.
Yes, and the propaganda will tell you that they have the backing of the factory workers, when in reality they only have the backing of 3 to 5% of the factory workers.
Top-ranking KGB defector Yuri Bezmianov defected, I believe, in the late 60s, early 70s, said that There is no such thing as a popular uprising or a revolt of the people. He said that all revolutions are guided, carefully planned years in advance, and they're handled by a few people behind the scenes who manipulate the crowds, and that there is
Absolutely.
No such thing as a popular, spontaneous revolt.
Absolutely. The average working class person, it takes an awful... You see in this country the amount of repression we've undergone the last 50 years, and the amount, the 10 or 20-fold rise in tax rates, the 10 or 20-fold rise in inflation. And does anybody out there look like they're ready to revolt against
the Jews,
anything?
The Jews haven't instigated the mob to rise up yet.
Absolutely not.
Their sham socialism resulted in the complete destruction of Russian industry and the country's enslavement to foreign capital and the destruction of all class organizations of the proletariat and the suppression of all democratic liberty and of all organs of the democratic state life, thus preparing the ground for a bourgeois counter-revolution of the worst and most brutal kind. The Bolsheviks are unable to solve the food problem. Well, of course they're not going to solve the food problem. They created the food problem to gain control. In their attempt to bribe the proletariat by organizing expeditions into the villages in order to seize supplies of bread, drives the peasantry into the arms of the counter-revolution and threatens to rouse its hatred towards the town in general, and the proletariat in particular, for a long time to come. In continuing the struggle against the Bolshevik tyranny, which dishonors the Russian Revolution, social democracy pursues the following aims. 1. To make it impossible for the working class to have to shed its blood for the sake of maintaining the sham dictatorship of the toiling masses or of the sham socialistic order, both of which are bound to perish and are meanwhile killing the soul and body of the proletariat. 2. To organize the working class into a force which, in union with other democratic forces of the country, will be able to throw off the yoke of the Bolshevik regime, to defend the democratic conquest of the revolution, and to oppose any reactionary force which would attempt to hang a millstone around the neck of the Russian democracy. 40 delegates elected by workmen of various towns to a conference for the purpose of making arrangements for the convocation of a labor congress have been arrested and committed for trial by the Supreme Revolutionary Tribunal, created to pass death sentences without the ordinary guarantees of a fair trial. They are falsely and calumniously accused of organizing a counter-revolutionary plot. Among the arrested are the most prominent workers of the social democratic labor movement, as, for instance, Abramovich, member of the Central Executive Committees of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party and of the Jewish Socialist Party. I think we could tell that from the name Abramovich. He definitely doesn't sound like your garden variety Russian, does he?
No, not at all.
Who was personally well known to many foreign comrades. Of course, they're all Jewish comrades. Alter, member of the Executive Committee of the Jewish Socialist Party, the Bund. Smirnov, member of last year's Soviet delegation to the Western countries. Veskohan, member of the Executive Committee of the Lettish Social Democratic Party. Volkov, chairman of the Petrograd Union of Workmen's Cooperative Societies. Zakharov, secretary of the Petrograd Union of Workmen of Chemical Factories, and other prominent workers of the trade unions and cooperative movement. We demand immediate intervention of all socialist parties to avert the shameful and criminal proceeding. Protest of the Social Democratic Labor Party and of the Jewish Socialist Party sent to the executive committees of all socialist parties of Europe and America, August 1918. So even in socialism and communism, the Jews still have to have their own little exclusive party, don't they? They can't just be socialists. They have to be Jewish socialists.
Well, it's basically the Bolshevik Marxists are eliminating all possible competition. And most of the competition they're eliminating are other Jewish socialists.
Yet when I tried to create a category in Wikipedia for Jewish communists, they deleted the category. You know, they have American communists, Russian communists, Ukrainian communists, and they're all Jews. So I figured it would just save time to create a Jewish communist category.
Yeah, that's incredible. How about Israel? Try creating a category for Israeli communists. Happens. Because that's a geographical political entity also. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, I believe they have a category for Israeli communists, but it's pathetically small.
Well, just put all the Jews' names into it. They're all Israelis, aren't they, no matter where they are? I mean, by their own claims. Okay.
All right, would you like to take over?
The Extraordinary Commission of the Union of Northern Communes, at a meeting of October 22nd, considered the legal cases connected with the Sailors' Mutiny of October 14th. It was found on examination that the movement was organized by the Petrograd Committee of the Socialist Revolutionaries of the Left. The resolution passed by the sailors of the 2nd Baltic Squadron, having been framed with the assistance of members of the above committee, approved of by the Conference of the Party, which sent its greetings to the sailors. Apart from this, the resolution was printed on a cyclostyle in the premises of the above committee, which delegated their party agitators to the sailors' meeting. So their party agitators, if they're not Leninists or Trotskyites, they're party agitators. Otherwise, they're great heroes of the revolution.
And then a decade later, if they were in line with Trotsky, they're dead.
Yeah, right. At the head of the organization were 13 persons. Two escaped. All the others were sentenced by the Extraordinary Commission to be shot. That was reported in Izvestia, October 31st, 1918. By the decision of the Extraordinary Commission, the socialist revolutionary Firsov has been shot. Firsov was executed for writing and distributing leaflets in which the socialist revolutionaries invited workmen to give allegiance to the Archangel's government. Archangelsk is actually a city on the White Sea, far north of Moscow. That was in the Northern Commune, September 18th, 1918. The Extraordinary Commission of the province has arrested the leading members of the local organization of left and right socialist social revolutionaries. So we have right-wing social revolutionaries, eh? For
aren't
the spreading of proclamations. Excuse me?
Oh, do you think we count as right-wing social revolutionaries?
Well, I don't know. The Jews can twist an adjective around everything, anything, and make it fit because words are fluid to them.
Mm-hmm.
The Extraordinary Commission of the province has arrested the leading members of the local organization of left and right social revolutionaries for the spreading of proclamations. In connection with the discovery of the plot, some left special revolutionaries have been arrested in Moscow. An agitation has been conducted in the Red Army for overthrow of Soviet authority. Proclamations were distributed calling for a struggle against Soviet authority, for the immediate organization of committees, and for the encouragement through chosen commanders of a campaign of terror against Trotsky and other prominent leaders of the Communist Party. The agitation and the proclamations were without success. The responsible worker of the Kaluga Provisions Commissariat, the left social revolutionary Prigalin, was arrested. A rough draft of a proclamation in the name of the party calling for the overthrow of the Bolsheviks and the establishment of a coalition without the Bolsheviks was found on him. Russian Wireless, February 22, 1919. The tribunal dealing with Mademoiselle Spiridonova, however you pronounce her name, the leader of the Social Revolutionary Party, who was recently arrested on a charge of conspiracy against the Soviet authority, has decided, in view of the abnormal state of mind of the accused, to isolate her from all political and social activity for the duration of a year. Mademoiselle Spiridonova is to be detained in a sanatorium where she will be allowed facilities for recreation and intellectual work. Russian Wireless, February 26, 1919.
You may recall I quoted from Charles Edward Russell's Bolshevism in America about Spiridonova, Marie Spiridonova. She was arrested, detained indefinitely, and ultimately they executed her, I think 20 years later, after she was institutionalized.
Why did they cut her somewhat slack and execute everybody else on site?
She was very popular, and they had to wait until people forgot who she was.
I think you spoke at length about that last 2 weeks ago, at the last program. Don't be like the old masters, quote-unquote. In one of the Sunday numbers of the Krasnaya Gazette, Red Gazette, there was an article by the comrade Kuznetsov under the title The 11th. In this article, he recalled how arrogantly, how appallingly, the old masters conducted themselves toward working men. Yes, comrade Kuznetsov, it is unpleasant and humiliating to recall this gentry, but it is even more unpleasant and humiliating to meet the same kind of old masters at the present time. I know very many comrades who occupy various responsible posts in unions and committees. And when you happen to turn them to them with some inquiry or request for cooperation, they are no better than the masters of the old regime. They answer either rudely or arrogantly, or they do not answer at all. It is humiliating to see this at the present time. And I say to such comrades, don't be, if I may so express myself, like the old masters. Go to meet the oppressed and the poor. Train yourselves in this spirit, and only then call yourselves communists and protectors of the working man. Hands off all those who do not act as they speak. Letter from a working man, Krasnaya Gazeta, the Red Gazette, Petrograd, October 29th, 1918, number 2.
You know he can't be a Jew then if he's honest about being a working man.
Well, right. I was just going to say, this letter could not have come from a Jew. It must have come from some stupid white sucker who was deceived into thinking that this whole Bolshevik working proletariat revolution was actually legitimate.
Absolutely. And I'd like to point out about Marie Spiridonova. She assassinated in 1905 a Russian police inspector general, shot him in the face at a railway station.
So she's a hero. That's why they treated her well.
And she was sent to Siberia. She was originally going to be sentenced to death, but she was spared the death sentence, sent into exile in Siberia, where she claims that the guards raped her and beat her and put out cigarettes on her breasts and whatnot and tortured her horrendously. It sounds like something out of a 1960s Jewish movie about what the Nazis did to them but never actually did. And then ultimately she was released by the Bolsheviks and then killed by the Bolsheviks. And I'd like to point out, you know, if the Tsar was as repressive as the Bolsheviks, wouldn't 1,000 social revolutionaries have been killed in reprisal for the assassination of that police general?
Absolutely. At least 1,000. I mean, the whole proletariat would have been wiped out.
Here they are, you know, one Jewish intellectual gets bumped off by another Jewish intellectual, and they're ready to kill 10,000 white people over it.
Right. And you know, I really hate to use the proletariat in reference to the working class.
Mm-hmm.
In old Rome, the word proletarius was used of those citizens who were so useless, the only thing they gave to benefit the nation was sons. Yeah, you know, to be used for cannon, to what we call today cannon fodder.
Mm.
The proletariat was the absolute lowest, Jerry Springer trailer trash. Or worse than that, on welfare would be considered the proletariat. And I hate to use that of the working class. Marx took that word and adapted it to his political viewpoint. But, you know, the Russian peasants and the Russian working class contributed greatly to society. They can't be considered proletarians in the Latin sense at all.
Jew looks at a constructive, contributing white man and says that he's doing nothing, whereas the Jewish intellectual who sits in his butt all day and simply thinks up ideas, so-called, ideas that could only spawn in the mind of a Jew and never deserve to see the light of day, he is the pinnacle of social achievement.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say, is from a normal viewpoint, and not from Marx's viewpoint, the word proletarius only accurately defines the Jew in Russia,
who
is not working and contributing to society.
The self-styled so-called intellectuals who are basically worthless.
Well, that's my point. Absolutely. They are the proletariat. And in that sense, the Bolsheviks are right in their use of the word proletariat. But it does not accurately describe the average Russian citizen who worked for a living and did contribute to society. In other words, even that is a lie. Even Marx's use of the word and the subsequent use of the word by the Jews is a lie. Okay, the Bolsheviks and the press. The suppression of the paper, Mir, which means peace, in accordance with the decision published in the Izvestia on the 27th of July, number 159, the press department granted permits to issue periodical publications which accepted the Soviet platform. When granting permissions, the press department took into consideration the available supplies of paper, whether the population was in need of the proposed periodical publication, and also the necessity of providing employment for printers and pressmen. Thus, permission was granted to issue the paper Mir, especially in view of the publisher's declaration that the paper was intended to propagate pacifist ideas. At the present moment, the requirements of the population of the Federal Socialist Republic for means of daily information are adequately met by the Soviet publications. Employment for those engaged in journalistic work is secured in the Soviet papers. A paper crisis is approaching. The press department, therefore, considers it impossible to permit the further publication of the Mir and has decided to suppress this paper forever. That was printed in Izvestia, October 17, 1918. Isn't that the one-year anniversary of the revolution?
I believe so.
The Central Executive Committee has confirmed the decision to close the newspaper, Vizegda V. Period, whatever that means. It's actually a V and a period. That's what I read, right?
I'd say like Viparod. Viparod.
Okay. Whatever, and as it appeals for the cessation of civil war, appear to be a betrayal of the working class. Russian Wireless, February 26, 1919. This is good. Compulsory purchase of newspapers. Excuse me. To the notice of the House Committees of Poverty, on the 20th of July of the present year, there was published Obligatory Regulation Number 27 to the following effect. Every House Committee in the city of Petrograd and other towns included in the Union of Communes of the Northern Region is under obligation to subscribe, paying for the same, to one copy of the newspaper, the Northern Commune, that's the name of the newspaper, the official organ of the Soviets of the Northern Region. The newspaper should be given to every resident in the House on the first demand. Chairman of the Union of the Communes of the Northern Region, Gregory Zinoviev, Commissary of Printing, N. Kuzmin. However, until now, the majority of houses, and this is commentary, inhabited preeminently by the bourgeois, do not fulfill the above-expressed obligatory regulation, and the working population of such houses is deprived of the possibility of receiving the Northern Commune in its House committees. Therefore, the publishing office of the Northern Commune brings to the notice of all House committees that it has undertaken, through the medium of a special emissaries, the control of the fulfillment by House committees of the obligatory regulation number 27, and all House committees which cannot show a receipt for a subscription to the newspaper, the Northern Commune, will be immediately called to the most severe account for the breaking of the obligatory regulation. Subscriptions will be received in the main office and branches of the Northern Commune daily, except Sundays and holidays, from 10 to 4. You mean the Bolsheviks allowed businesses to close down on Sundays? Severnaya Communa, Petrograd, November 10, 1918, printed that. And this is like the New York Times getting a decree that everybody in the country had to buy a copy, and they were empowered to enforce it.
And that's one way that the Jews will bolster their sagging subscription rates.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, in this country, don't they have de facto monopoly over your exposure to information. They mandate that you send your children to school in almost every single state, and in many states that allow homeschooling, they control the curriculum.
Right. And
so your children will get a healthy dose of hoaxacost propaganda.
And the homeschooling movement is really despised by the educational unions because it threatens. They feel threatened by it. How dare you not want to be brainwashed by us?
You know, in Germany, they prohibit homeschooling. There are about maybe an estimated 400 to 500 families that homeschool. But if they're found out, they face arrests, indictments with felony charges, and they definitely will lose custody of their children. The German government has stated that homeschooling does not assure that the children will be raised to be citizens in a global community in a multiracial, multicultural, diverse nation with tolerant New Age values. They say that the homeschooling parents may indoctrinate them with religion or values that are not consistent with those of the United Nations Charter. I mean,
okay, this
is right out of Revelation, isn't it?
Basically, freedom of speech. At the People's Court at Moscow was heard the case of priest Filimonov, accused of circulating the book Who Governs Us? Probably complaining about the Jews, eh?
Absolutely.
In his book, the author defamed the Soviet government. The court sentenced the Reverend Father to 10 years of public work. Krasnaya Gazeta, Petrograd, October 10th, 1918.
And I'm sure the Soviet Union had their own branch of the ADL. It was called the Cheka.
Yes, I'm certain. Decree as to freedom of association and public meetings. 1. All societies, unions, and associations, political, economic, artistic, religious, etc., formed on the territory of the Union of the Commune of the Northern Region, must be registered at the corresponding Soviets or committees of the village poor. 2. The constitution of the union or society, a list of founders and members of the committee with names and addresses, and a list of all members with their names and addresses must be submitted at registration. 3. So you don't want to join anything, do you? 3. All books, minutes, etc., must always be kept at the disposal of representatives of the Soviet power for purposes of revision. That's interesting. That they'll write what they believe happened in your meeting. 4. 3 days' notice must be given to the Soviet or to the Committee of the Village Poor of all public and private meetings. 5. All meetings must be open to representatives of the Soviet power, the representatives of the Central and District Soviet, the Committee of the Poor, and the Commandature of the Revolutionary Secret Police Force, the Okhrana. 6. Unions and societies which do not comply with those regulations will be regarded as counter-revolutionary organizations and prosecuted. September.
Translation, if you don't let them spy on your private family gatherings, you're all going to get shot.
Right. You want to start with economic conditions?
Economic conditions, A, wages, the rise in wages. In the last number of the Narodnaya Kuznetsovo National Economy are given the figures of the progress of wages in Russia during the decade of 1908 to 1918. In general, wages have risen during the 10 years from 1,200 to 1,300%. The highest rise has taken place in the textile industry, in which it has reached 1,736%. In the leather trade, the wages have gone up in the same time 1,501%. In the color printing industry, 1,440%. In the writing paper industry, 1,434%. In the metal and woodworks industry, 1,004%. In the chemical industry, 1,069%. And in the food products industry, 1,286%. It is necessary to remark that the greatest changes have occurred in those branches of industry which received smaller wages in previous years, as, for example, the textile industry. In this connection, the wages of the women workers have risen relatively far in excess of those of the men workers. In the leather industry, they have reached a 2,500% increase. in the textile industry, 2,127%. Pravda, Moscow, October 24, 1918, number 230.
I have a problem with these numbers. This rise in wages. Now, we've read in the Russian number one report that there was very severe inflation.
Yes, so they're being paid in worthless funny money.
And all of this inflation didn't happen over 10 years. It happened over 1 year.
Yes.
It didn't happen from 1908 to 1917.
It happened from 1917 to 1918.
Right. And why would they publish numbers they have to lie about? I mean, they're trying to show how great it's been for the working man. Why would they start in 1908?
Absolutely, and it looks like, I wonder if there are any Jewish feminists in Russia complaining that women are making more money than men.
Yeah, right.
You know, they probably are. I wonder if they're there saying, women make 1.7 rubles on the male 1 ruble. It's not fair that a man. You know how in this country they always bellyache and moan that women make 70 cents on the male dollar, but that's been thoroughly debunked. Food. What they can get with their higher wages. The bread ration. The commissary of food of the Petrograd Labor Commune informs that on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday for 4 days, the following products will be given on the presentation of the bread carts according to category. First category, 1 pound Russian of bread and 3 pounds of potatoes. Second category, half a pound of bread and 2 pounds of potatoes. Third category, 1/4 pound of bread and 1 pound of potatoes. Fourth category, half a pound of potatoes. I suppose the fourth category would be the bourgeois, the people that actually work for a living. They get the least. And the first category is probably government officials and revolutionary intellectuals.
And the soldiers.
Yes. And that was reported in Voronezh Narod, The Armed People, Petrograd, October 9, 1918, number 71. Rations for October. For the month of October, the second free coupon will be available for the following products. First category, 1 pound of fresh fish, 1/4 pound of leeks. Second category, 2 herrings, 1/4 pound of leeks. Krasnaya Gazeta, the Red Gazette, October 10, 1918, number 214. The population of Petrograd. The population of Petrograd is continuing steadily to decrease. According to figures furnished by the Department of Statistics of the Food Commissariat, at the beginning of the month of October, there were 1.12 million food cards in the hands of the population. Of this number, there were 308,156 cards in the first category, 424,558 in the second, 85,691 in the third, and 1,669 in the fourth. Krasnaya Gazeta, Red Gazette, Petrograd, October 16, 1918, number 219. The vegetable ration for the month of October. Owing to the increased arrival of vegetables in Petrograd during the month of October, the third free coupon of the food cards will become available for the following, according to category. First category, 3 pounds of cabbage and 1 pound of onions. Second category, 2 pounds of cabbage and 1 pound of onions. Owing to technical conditions, the vegetables will be given out according to their arrivals at the stores of the commissariat, that is, not simultaneously in all the districts. Krasnaya Gazeta, Red Gazette, Petrograd, October 22, 1918, number 224. The Commissariat of Food. The Food Commissariat of the Petrograd Workers' Commune informs the population that in February, the adult population and children of all ages will be able to obtain on the presentation of their food cards, coupon 14. First category, 1 pound of sand sugar. Second category, half pound of sand sugar. Severnaya Komuna, Petrograd, February 6, 1919. Ostashkov. In consequence of a complete absence of groats, white flour, and milk products, children suffer immensely. The mortality is great. Izvestia, November 2nd, number 240. C. Health. In the districts of the Vyatka government, Spanish sickness is raging. I would assume they're talking about the 1918 epidemic of Spanish influenza.
Yes, they have to be.
There is no medical help, no drugs are available. The population, frightened by the high mortality, asks for help. There's an epidemic of gripe. Did I read that right? Gripe or gripe?
Gripe. I'm not sure what it means.
Must be a Russian word. And sit near Volots. 200 have died. Good agitators are urgently required. Izvestia, October 31, 1918. So they're going to use this as an opportunity to agitate and what, blame the epidemic on the Tsar?
It looks like grip has something to do with seizures. I'm looking at it now. It's grip from Old French, and it's pronounced just grip, meaning clara, quarrel, to seize, grasp, from Frankish medicine, a former name for influenza. That's it.
All right. Disease, eruptive typhus. Last week there were 967 registered cases of eruptive typhus in Petrograd, as against 820 registered cases the previous week. Izvestia, Moscow, February 7, 1919, number 28, 580. Now, I wonder, are they going to blame the spread of disease on the Anglo-French agents that are operating everywhere, supposedly?
Well, we haven't seen it yet, but I'm sure they plotted it.
From an analysis of the Krasnaya Gazeta, the Red Gazette, Petrograd, we get the following facts. In the issue of October 10, 1918, there are 39 advertisements. Of these, 23 deal with syphilis treatment.
That sounds like America today. That sounds like the internet.
You turn on the TV and there's an ad for how you can treat your genital herpes outbreaks, but how it's still possible to pass herpes to others.
Well, yeah, but I mean the level to which society sunk. I mean, on a lot of websites you'll see 10 ads and 8 of them are for sex products and weight loss.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, there's no substance to any of them, in other words.
Yes.
None of them are for real products, hardly.
Or you get a deluge of emails on penis enlargement.
Right.
In the issue of October 11, there are 33 advertisements. Of these, 18 deal with syphilis treatment. Of the 36 advertisements in the issue of October 16, 18 deal with syphilis treatment. Of the 42 advertisements in the issue of November 6, 25 deal with syphilis and other venereal diseases. I think we're seeing a pattern emerging here. D, requisitions. At a plenary sitting of the Soviet of Workers' Deputies of the City Region, in connection with events in Germany, a resolution was passed in favor of sending a greeting to the German proletariat and promise of being in readiness for sending assistance in the form of arms and food. In connection with this, in view of the fact that this question is inevitably bound up with the security of our Red Army, the Soviet has decided to take the measure of requisitioning warm things belonging to the bourgeois for the Red Army. Krasnaya Gazeta, the Red Gazette, Petrograd, October 11, 1918, number 215. So it's absolutely clear the Soviets were intending to spread their Bolshevik revolution into Germany, and they darn well succeeded, and they would have had it not been for the Freikorps.
Absolutely. There's no doubt.
The collection of warm things without the 1,000-ruble fine has been prolonged until October 20, inclusive. Krasnaya Gazeta, Red Gazette, Petrograd, October 16, 1918, number 219. Compulsory labor. Compulsory labor for hawkers, cabmen, etc. Within a few days, a registration will be made of all hawkers, cabmen, and unemployed of both sexes. All these persons will be summoned to do urgent work caused by special conditions. Krasnaya Gazeta, Red Gazette, Petrograd, November 2, 1918, number 234. The Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party informs all party organizations that all responsible workmen, Ukrainians, Letts, White Russians, and comrades of other nationalities will be freed from their local labors and sent to their own country only by permission of the Central Committee. All secondary workmen will be freed by permission of the local organization if their departure from their post does not involve a breakdown of the local work. Russian Wireless, February 5, 1919. In other words, you're basically a slave and you're the state, your post.
Right. That's we see socialism is total control over every facet of life. And this all illustrates the Bolshevik consolidation of that total control.
Absolutely. Do you have any, how would you like to, do you have any closing thoughts on this article?
Well, no, I don't know how we could close this up except by going right into the Nazi Germany sphere, or I shouldn't say the Nazi Germany, because 1920s Germany saw this and feared it, and they were afraid of it happening there. The Freikorps stopped it. The Freikorps stopped it in 1919. Hmm. When the government, the Kaiser's government was destabilized, it fell apart. The replacement government was fledgling and new,
and not yet stable. And the time was ripe for a Bolshevik revolution. And the militia stopped it.
Well, that's why the Jews insisted that the German army be limited to 100,000 men. They knew that the German army wouldn't be strong enough to stop all the left revolutionaries.
Well, right, but the Freikorps was all volunteers.
Mm-hmm. The Freikorps,
they were mostly veterans, but they were all volunteers.
They were volunteers who kept their equipment and refused to disband. They figured if they're going to be unemployed, they might as well go around and shoot communists.
Exactly.
And it's a darn shame more people in this country didn't have that attitude in the 50s and 60s. We probably wouldn't be where we are today.
Absolutely not.
All right, then. So next week we will kick things off with Goebbels and Bolshevism in theory and practice.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Thank you.